Friday, October 30th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, a wave of cyber attacks strike dozens of U.S. hospitals as government officials urge diligence. France raises its security level to its highest after a deadly terror attack at a church in Nice.
They will be controlling sensitive parts across the country, such as places of worship, schools, media organizations.
Also ahead, with just days to go, Donald Trump and Joe Biden take the campaign battle to the critical state of Florida. It's all on today's International Edition. In the final stretch of the presidential campaign, President Donald Trump and Democratic rival Joe Biden both rallied supporters on Thursday in a critical battleground state, putting their differing approaches to the resurgent coronavirus pandemic on full display. AP Washington correspondent Sagar Magani reports.
Florida is always close, and Biden knows the president all but must win there to earn another term.
If Florida goes blue, it's over.
The president was on the state's west coast hours before Biden also ventured to the Tampa area.
We're doing incredibly in Florida. We're doing incredibly all over.
More than 73 million Americans have already voted, and both men are trying to energize the millions more who'll turn out Tuesday. The president was to have a second rally today in another southern battleground, North Carolina, which was postponed until next week due to strong winds. Sagar Magani, Washington.
With 5 days to go until voting finishes in the U.S. election, the campaigns are trying to drum up every last vote from their supporters. The latest average polls data show Biden leading Trump nationally by more than 7%. For more on the two candidates' strategies in the final week of the election, VOA's Jason Patinkin spoke to VOA executive producer Steve Reddish in Washington.
President Trump has been campaigning in states in which he won in 2016, instead of trying to expand his voter appeal, he's been going back to Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania for the most part. In trying to get his own voters that he knows are supporting him, trying to drive up voter participation and voter turnout in areas that he already knows he has voters. On the other hand, Joe Biden is trying to expand the map. Tuesday, he went into Georgia. No Democrat has won Georgia since 1992. So Joe Biden sees the opportunities to add states to his electoral count, while President Trump has been backtracking and trying to make sure that the voter turnout in states that he won in 2016 will come back and vote for him again.
So basically, Trump is playing defense, trying to hold the places he won in 2016, while Biden is going on offense, trying to get more states.
Correct. Biden sees the opportunity to, much like Hillary Clinton saw in 2016, to try and add on states to what he sees as an already growing voter base, and trying to help Senate candidates and other candidates, other Democrats running in these usually red, reliably Republican states like Texas and Georgia, to try and find new voters and help local Democrats in that state raise their base. Hillary Clinton was criticized for doing this in 2016. Instead of concentrating on states that she knew and the campaign knew were going to be tight, like Wisconsin and Michigan and Pennsylvania, Hillary Clinton went and tried to grab off some voters in Texas and in Arizona.
Now, Hillary's strategy, which did not work, was in part based on polls, which showed her leading Trump by quite a bit. And again, this year, polls show that Biden is leading Trump by quite a bit. How much trust should people put in these polls?
There's been a lot of criticism about polling, especially from the 2016 election, where polls showed that Hillary Clinton was leading nationwide in the vote. And those polls reflected pretty much accurately the national vote, where Hillary Clinton won the national vote but lost in the Electoral College because she lost about three states, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, and Michigan, by vote margins of less than 100,000 votes in some cases, some less than 40,000 votes in other cases. The polls in those individual states were not as accurate as pollsters had hoped. For the most part, many of the polling companies that do conduct opinion surveys have changed some of their methodologies, taking into account a key demographic factor, which is the education of the electorate. The 2016 election showed that Donald Trump outperformed Hillary Clinton in a demographic category of non-college educated white men and women. And that's where his vote surged, and most pollsters did not see this coming in 2016. In 2020, they've adjusted their models, they've adjusted their methodology, and most of the observers of how polling is conducted, they're saying that for the most part, these polls are relatively accurate. They reflect some changes in the methodology, and for the most part, many, many people are trusting the polls while still saying, but wait a minute, we saw what happened in 2016, so let's not put all of our trust in all of these polls.
VOA executive producer Steve Reddish speaking with my colleague Jason Patinkin. Walmart, the world's largest retailer, has removed firearms and ammunition from U.S. store floors this week to protect customers and employees as tensions across the country have been rising. The move comes days ahead of concerns that the Election Day result could be contested or spark violence. Voters in California are deciding on Election Day on an initiative that would keep people who work in the so-called gig economy as independent contractors, not employees. Michelle Quinn reports.
When her employer cut her hours, Maria Hernandez, a healthcare worker, turned to driving for Lyft, the ride-hailing firm, to make up lost income. She likes it, meeting people and picking up work when she can.
I think the flexibility is a wonderful thing because it has helped me a lot with my other job.
The so-called gig economy, which uses apps to connect people like Hernandez to jobs, is under threat in the Golden State. Voters are deciding on Proposition 22, a ballot initiative sponsored by companies like Uber, Lyft, DoorDash, and others. They have spent nearly $200 million on it, the most ever for a state initiative. A lot is at stake. If Prop 22 passes, it would keep drivers like Hernandez as independent contractors. Opponents include major labor unions who argue that there is already a state law which the firms are challenging, requiring them to treat workers as employees with protections such as sick leave, overtime, and other benefits. Among Uber and Lyft drivers, there's a divide over the initiative, says Chris Gerassi, a contributor to The Rideshare Guy, a media outlet for gig economy workers, and an Uber driver in Buffalo, New York. Full-time drivers tend to support the initiative, he said, while the majority of drivers, part-timers like himself, value flexibility. He has one idea that would make more drivers happy.
Better pay rates would probably be the way to erase the majority of these issues that we're having between the minority of drivers who wanted employee status versus the vast majority who are doing it part-time.
At a recent protest against the initiative in San Francisco, some drivers said they had had enough. One of them, Daniel, is an Uber driver.
I'm here because I'm a rideshare driver. I've given close to 20,000 rides, and so I'm very familiar with the exploitation that these companies put us through. We have low pay. We have no access to benefits. It's just unjust.
Ken Jacobs, the chair of the Labor Center at the University of California, Berkeley, argues that if the ballot initiative passes, it will send a signal to other governments seeking to get the companies to comply with labor laws.
If it passes, then they send a very strong signal to other states in the U.S. who are looking to enforce their own wage and hour laws and other countries that not only will they not abide by the laws, but that they've amassed enough money that they have the power to change laws that do not allow them to do whatever they want to do.
One thing is certain. The stakes are high for workers and customers in this battle over the future of work. Michelle Quinn, VOA News, San Francisco.
Hours before a nationwide coronavirus lockdown, security in France has been raised to its highest level following what officials call a terror attack in the city of Nice. Authorities say a 21-year-old Tunisian man fatally stabbed three people at the Notre Dame Basilica on Thursday. The suspect was wounded by police in what is the third attack in less than 2 months, including the grisly beheading of a teacher who had shown caricatures of the Prophet Muhammad in class. An angry French President Emmanuel Macron addressed the nation from outside the church, where he announced new security measures. Joining us for the very latest is Paris-based reporter Catherine Field. Catherine, such a sad situation. What did the president say?
Within a few hours of the Nice attack, French President Emmanuel Macron announced that he was ordering a reinforcement of troops, police, and security personnel across the country. At the moment, there are 3,000 troops on patrol at sensitive sites across the country. Within the next 24 hours, that will be increased to some 7,000. Now, they will be patrolling sensitive sites across the country, such as places of worship, schools, media organizations. And the president has also said there will be additional security put in place around Catholic churches and cemeteries ahead of this weekend's All Saints Holy Day.
Catherine, given that this was the third horrific terror attack in less than 2 months, is there any sort of common thread with what's been happening?
There is, and police are pointing in particular to the fact that these three attacks have all been lone wolf attacks carried out by people who are new to France, each having different cultural backgrounds, not aligned to any particular organization. The attacks weren't claimed by particular organizations. And what they seem to have in common was they all wanted to avenge the publication in France of cartoons of the Prophet Muhammad. Just thinking, less than 2 weeks ago, the beheading of an intermediate school teacher in a suburb just outside of Paris. That again, lone wolf. We're looking at attacks that are carried out by men on their own, carrying one simple knife, sometimes no more than 10 inches long, and going into places, sacred places, such as churches, or in the case of a school, and carrying out these attacks that are really just very random.
What else of significance did President Macron say?
It was a very robust and very defiant President Macron who spoke after he'd visited the site of the attack. He said that this was an Islamist terrorist attack. He said it was an attack on French values. He said it was done by people who really don't respect the freedoms that French people enjoy. He said, and I'm quoting here, "We will not give them ground." And he reinforced the message that it is France who sets the rules and not members of fringe communities who feel that they are being hurt in some manner by somebody publishing a cartoon. He said very clearly, everyone has the right to a religion in France, and everyone has the right not to have a religion, but you don't have the right to go out and kill.
Paris-based reporter Catherine Field, thank you so much as always. Global coronavirus cases rose by 500,000 for the first time on Wednesday, a record one-day increase as countries across the Northern Hemisphere reported daily spikes. The virus is surging across Europe and the U.S. The White House Coronavirus Task Force is warning that much of the country is in the grips of an unrelenting rise in COVID-19 cases. In an interview on CNBC's The News with Shepard Smith, Dr. Anthony Fauci, the nation's top infectious disease expert, said coronavirus cases are on the rise in 47 states and patients are beginning to overwhelm hospitals across the country.
This is going to get worse because we're going more into a colder season as we get through the fall and into the winter. With the holiday season going, we've got to do something different. We can't just let this happen.
Urging aggressive countermeasures, Fauci said, with more hospitalizations, there will be more deaths.
So this is an untenable situation.
He urged aggressive countermeasures. In the midst of a pandemic that threatens to overwhelm healthcare workers, federal officials revealed this week that dozens of U.S. hospitals have been victims of ransomware attacks, urged facilities to back up their record-keeping databases and other critical medical information systems. Some of the incidents occurred in Oregon, California, and New York. VOA national security correspondent Jeff Selden joins us now for more on this developing story. Jeff, what can you tell us about this cyber attack coming just days also before the U.S. presidential election?
Well, this has been a concern, something that U.S. officials, cybersecurity officials have been worried about for some time, especially with the election coming up. They said there's a possibility that either state actors or criminal cyber actors might try to target critical U.S. infrastructure not directly related to the election to cause chaos, to cause concern. In this case, what the FBI and the cyber security and infrastructure security agency said was that over the past couple of days, there have been a series of ransomware attacks on U.S. hospitals. Specifically, these are attacks where malware is put onto the system. It locks up the hospital system. And the only way for the hospitals to get access to their databases, to their computer systems, is to pay out to the cyber actors. And once they make a payment, sometimes cyber actors will say, okay, now you have access to your system again. Of course, in the process, the cyber actors can steal information, can mess with information. It's a big concern. In this case, there was a series of attacks, 2 to 3 hospitals being hit over a couple of days all across the U.S. Some of them, as a result, had to divert patients to other healthcare locations. So the FBI and CISA, these cybersecurity officials, put out a warning nationwide telling hospitals, be out on the alert, look out, don't click on links and emails unless you're absolutely sure where they came from.
What are officials saying as far as the level of concern over these attacks?
There's a big level of concern because of how much it's been happening. It's been rare to see this level of attack against hospitals. There have been attacks against hospitals before, but the rapidity of one after another has them worried. Some private cybersecurity experts have also said that the way that this group appears to be going about it, and they've been identified either as Russian or as Eastern European criminals by some of these cyber experts, has been particularly vicious. And they're worried, especially because some of the states that they've been targeting, some of these hospitals have been under a lot of stress anyway because of the coronavirus pandemic. And with cases spiking in parts of the U.S., there's a huge demand for hospital services. So they're going after that capability at this time.
Is there any indication as to what the motive would be in this sort of security breach or security threat?
Well, there could be a couple of motives. The most obvious one is for cyber criminals who want to make money. They can lock up these systems of hospitals. These are critical systems, information that the hospitals need to be able to operate, and say, either you pay us a lot of money or you can't operate, and then you've got lots of problems. There are cases where the government generally advises people not to pay out. There are times where hospitals, where businesses that are affected by ransomware attacks, governments even, will pay out because they feel that they just need to get access to their systems again. So that's one motive. There's another motive too, because there is this nexus between cyber criminals and some state-based actors, including Russia, including China, including Iran. And sometimes the criminal actors will be pushed to make moves like this at the behest of a state actor, like in the case of Russia or China or Iran. With the election coming up, chaos is something that those U.S. adversaries desire. They want to see the U.S. being confused, having to deal with these sorts of problems. Also, sometimes it's just to get access to the information. The ransomware and the possibility of a payment immediately is a second thought. What they're really targeting can be the information held in those hospitals, held in those systems, and it's something that they plan to use for some purpose later on.
VOA national security correspondent Jeff Selden. The World Meteorological Organization predicts La Nina will continue through January and is expected to usher in drier and wetter conditions than normal in different parts of the world. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The latest seasonal forecasts indicate the La Nina event will cause drier than normal conditions in much of East Africa and lead to increased rainfall in southern Africa. Central Asia is likely to see below normal rainfall earlier than usual. The World Meteorological Organization reports some of the Pacific Islands in the northern region of South America will see some of the most significant precipitation anomalies associated with this year's La Nina event. A cooling of ocean surface water along the Pacific coast of the South American tropics that occurs on average every 2 to 7 years. Some countries and regions are particularly vulnerable to changes in weather patterns. WMO humanitarian expert Gavin Eiley tells VOA the Greater Horn of Africa is an area of particular concern.
As we know, it's already been beset by problems with locust infestation, and generally the models are suggesting below normal rainfall for quite a large portion of the Greater Horn of Africa. So obviously that could have a number of impacts, but in areas like Somalia, so we always need to keep an eye on the sort of latest outlook.
WMO says governments can use weather forecasts to plan ways to reduce adverse impacts in climate-sensitive sectors like agriculture, health, water resources, and disaster management. WMO Deputy Director of Climate Services Max Dilley says governments can use La Nina forecasting to adapt their strategies to the changing weather patterns.
You can imagine in the agricultural sector that some crops will do well under wet conditions and others will do better under dry conditions. And there are agricultural management practices that can be adjusted to take account of whether it's expected to be wet or dry.
Dilley says WMO increasingly is trying to tailor these forecasts to specific concerns, such as food security or human health. For example, he says wet conditions alone do not provoke outbreaks of dengue fever or malaria. He says temperature, humidity, and also vegetation create the conditions for mosquitoes to breed. So rather than just giving a rainfall forecast, he says meteorologists will provide a forecast that is correlated with these diseases and can be used for dengue fever or malaria control. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo has urged Indonesian leaders to speak up about the condition of ethnic Uyghur Muslims in China's Xinjiang region. Pompeo made the comments Thursday as he delivered a religious freedom speech during his visit to Indonesia, the world's most populous Muslim country. VOA diplomatic correspondent Cindy Sain reports.
On his tour of South Asia, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo continued his push against China. In meetings with Indonesian leaders, Pompeo accused the Chinese Communist Party, or the CCP, of being the greatest threat to religious freedom in the world. He said Beijing has brutalized Uyghur Muslims and other minorities under the pretense of countering terrorism or alleviating poverty. But the real goal, he said, is about surveillance and control. Speaking to a Muslim group, Pompeo urged them to show solidarity with ethnic Muslims in China. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo.
I know that the Chinese Communist Party has tried to convince Indonesians to look away from the torments your fellow Muslims are suffering. I know that these same CCP officials have spun fantastic tales of happy Uyghurs eager to discard their ethnic, religious, and cultural identities to become more modern and enjoy the benefits of CCP-led development. When you hear these arguments, I just ask you to do this. Search your hearts.
The United States, other Western countries, and human rights groups strongly condemn the Chinese government for detaining more than 1 million Uyghurs in camps in Xinjiang, where they are forced to assimilate by having their Islamic heritage erased. China denies the persecution, calling the detention camps vocational centers. Human rights advocates have called on leaders across the world to speak up about the massive scale of the camps in China. Joanne Lin of Amnesty International welcomes Pompeo's comments. Joanne Lin of Amnesty International USA.
China has a very despairing and atrocious human rights record. And it's critical that all world leaders, including world leaders of predominantly Muslim-majority countries, raise their concerns with Chinese authorities about China's treatment of Uyghurs.
Pompeo praised his host in Jakarta, saying Indonesia has been a model of a country where people of different faiths, different ethnic groups, and different political ideologies can coexist peacefully. Cindy Sain, VOA News, Washington.
And you're listening to International Edition.
Join your host, Larry London, for Border Crossings, VOA's Worldwide Music Request Hour, every weekday at 1500 Universal. Tune in to hear your favorite songs and artists, win prizes and giveaways, and get the latest scoop from exclusive celebrity interviews. Send in requests to our Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram, or call 202-618-2077 to have your favorite music played for the entire world. Don't miss Border Crossings every weekday at 1500 Universal.
VOA's International Edition continues. The coronavirus pandemic has prevented large gatherings, as well as the age-old tradition in the U.S. of trick-or-treating. One group in L.A. is trying to bring some cheer by creating a drive-through Halloween event for children who can socially distance but still enjoy a few scares and get some treats. Gina Dulot reports.
The threat of COVID-19 infection is limiting most gatherings, from large holiday celebrations to small birthday parties. So what happens when your child's birthday falls on October 31st, better known as Halloween? Well, if Dad is the CEO of Experiential Supply, the company that creates large-scale immersive experiences for big Hollywood movies, you get Hauntoween LA, a several city blocks long drive-through event.
Happy Halloween!
The scary sights and sounds are bringing socially distant joy to Los Angeles residents.
It's been so sad because we haven't been able to do anything for Halloween. So when we saw this was here, we were so excited to come.
We're not being able to go trick-or-treating or seeing our friends. So, like, this is a really good, like, escape and way to get into the Halloween spirit.
Employing all coronavirus precautions such as masks, social distancing, and sanitized pumpkins, the experience takes visitors through a jack-o'-lantern tunnel, a giant pumpkin patch, trick-or-treating lane in the town of Hauntoween, inhabited by various scary characters.
It gets crazy after dark. Gotta watch out for the witches, because they got all the tricks and the treats.
The main challenge, according to the creators, was the size of the drive-through event.
We're literally at 30,000 pumpkins or more, probably about 7,000 stacks of hay, or hay stacks, or hay bales. It's just the amount of space that we've been able to cover, and we wanted to make sure that it wasn't just a quick drive-through, that literally people got to have an experience.
Interest in drive-throughs, an essential part of California lifestyle for decades, had been waning. But with limits to crowd sizes brought on by the coronavirus pandemic, business is booming again.
They've had drive-through wedding chapels, drive-through, of course, drive-in movie theaters, which are back now very strong. There's drive-in movies everywhere. Drive-through funeral parlors they had.
A conservation group offered another Halloween drive-through experience, a self-guided tour of five storybook-style houses in the city.
Storybook architecture is meant to kind of inspire this fantasy of the past and this fantasy of the magical creatures that are living inside, whether it's sort of hobbits or witches or warlocks or goblins. And all the houses on this trail have that kind of fantastical, whimsical quality.
So, despite the pandemic, inventive minds have conjured a Halloween season for Los Angeles residents. Genia Dulo for VOA News, Los Angeles, California.
And in music news, Paris Jackson has turned coping with the heartache of a recent breakup into her debut solo album. The 22-year-old daughter of Michael Jackson has written 11 songs for the concept album Wilted, an ethereal acoustic sound which she calls alternative folk. Jackson was one half of an acoustic duo, the Soundflowers, with boyfriend Gabriel Glenn until the two split earlier this year. But Jackson turned her pain into art. Her new single, Let Down, drops today, and Wilted, released by Republic Records, will be out November 13th. You've been listening to International Edition. That's it for our show today, but you can always find us at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Jackson Vungani, I'm Lori London in Washington. Thank you so much for listening. Have a great weekend.